Well, hello again, everybody, and welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today we are continuing on with our two-parter of Pipe of Maru and Apocrypha with Apocrypha in our mythology series. But before we get to that, Jen, how about some tweets of the week?
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These ones were in response to our episode about the mythology episode, Piper Maru. And lots of interesting thoughts from our listeners about that. From Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo, I just want to say thanks to Annie for making me laugh so hard when she cussed and cursed at the various means of transportation in Piper Maru. Other than that, your discussion was thoroughly enjoyable as usual, waiting impatiently for the next steps. Thanks, Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo. Cussing and cursing, Annie.
I cuss and curse a lot. I don't remember what she's referring to, but you're welcome. We entertain ourselves around here too, so I'm sure I enjoyed saying it as much as you enjoyed hearing it.
Yeah, honestly, yeah, we enjoy ourselves, so I'm glad. It's just like a bonus to me that other people find it entertaining as well. Kathy G said, great insights on the different approaches Mulder and Scully take in seeking truth. I never thought of it that way, but it makes complete sense. Of course, Scully wants justice for Militia through official channels. Of course, Mulder wants to know what his sister went through and why. Thanks, Kathy. Yeah, we talked about that a bit in the Piper Maru analysis about the difference in sort of what is the goal in terms of what they are searching for. What do Mulder and Scully want in the end? And it does say a lot about their characters, I think.
Yeah. And that was funny because it wasn't even something I had really thought about before until I was watching the episode. And then it kind of... But it's definitely a recurring theme between the two of them.
It is.
So yeah. I really think that's true. And thanks, Kathy, for agreeing.
Very cool. Isidub said, you made me laugh out loud several times when listening to the Piper Maru episode about Kimberly. Scully, will she, won't she run over the kids and the airport scenes with the sign and Mulder and Krycek? I didn't know before this episode was so funny. Thank you to make my day. We didn't really either, Isidub.
Yeah,
I don't know what to say. It's not necessarily a funny episode, but we somehow made it funny.
We can find the funny. I don't know, but the second you brought up the airport sign, I just like that airport sign just makes me laugh.
I'm just thinking about the airport sign, I have to say.
I mean, they were in season 3. They had a budget for a freaking airport sign. Like, come on.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Yeah.
Various at the same time. So I'm glad that we were able to bring a bit of spice with that.
Yeah.
Monica Filefan said, I love the parts with her banter and teamwork throughout, but my fave part is Scully letting loose her frustration and utter disappointment about Melissa's case so perfectly and knowing how she carries that burden now, much like Mulder has for years. It is painful to see. It is, isn't it, Monica? Monica also says, Jillian and Piper both have the same circle tat on their hand, just as an added correlation tidbit. That's very interesting, I think, Annie, because we talked about the idea that the word Maru, we think, at least I think, has something to do with the word circle, and that you suggested, Annie, that that might be why Jillian has that circle tattoo. But now to find out that Piper has one as well,
yeah,
just lends credence to that theory, I think.
It's all coming together.
Sure is. And also a shout out to Monica Filefan for giving us a shout out when Friday the 13th Horror Podcast asked for recommendations and thoughts about other podcasts. And Monica Filefan said, the X-Files Diaries podcast keeps my files so well fed with amazing MSR content and the best episode combos around. Thank you, Monica Filefan.
Thanks, Mon.
Kind of like blushed with joy about that, so thanks for that. Made me feel all pink inside. Erica Deb said, I have to say I rarely rewatch the mythology episodes, but this series you guys do is such a great reminder of how good they are. I need to stop rewatching only my favorites and mix it up a little. Yes, you do, Erica. That's
yes.
A great idea. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that because so many of my favorites are actually mythology episodes. So it's always fun for me to hear that everyone's idea of favorites is something totally different. And for Erica, it doesn't include mythology at all by the sounds of things. So by all means, mix it up, Erica, because there's some great mythology apps.
Yeah, but I mean, even though like a lot of my favorites are mythology as well, but like they aren't, there are so many. And if you even rewatch the same ones over and over again, you're not really getting the whole picture.
That's right.
And there's lots of details that you're missing. True. And so definitely like folks, rewatch with us, rewatch the mythology, just like all in order. I probably said this in our first mythology series episode, but like I have done before a full mythology rewatch where I just completely binged all of the mythology series back to back to back to back. And it wasn't the most entertaining way to spend all that time, because there are a lot that are a little, they can be difficult to watch and they can be confusing and like it's a lot to take in. That's what she said. Sorry. but I apologize. I've been doing that for several weeks now.
I'm good with it.
But it is really, really worthwhile to do that. And I think that you definitely, you can't get the same amount of information when you're watching it live or if you've only watched a lot of these episodes a long time ago, because they do just pack so much information into all of these. So it's definitely worth it to just even, pop in. Like if we're talking about an episode that you're like, I don't remember that one, I haven't watched that one in 10 years, pop it in, guys. Check it out because it's really, really worth it.
Yeah. I mean, I had not watched Piper Maru in a long time because that is one that just did not stand out in my memory, because I do tend to watch my favorite mythology episodes. So it is worthwhile to go through them all, like you say, and especially in order, and especially taking note of the plot and not just, you know, the character and the MSR, which like, is what I usually
how
notice.
How beautiful they look. They look so good in this episode. Look how they're dressed. Yeah. They're so flirty. I know we get distracted with that stuff. Often.
And I mean, you know, that's all great, but it's easy to miss the plot elements with all that other great stuff.
Yeah.
And so paying extra attention to the plot this time around is really paying off for me. It's very rewarding. And I think the fact that what you say about, you know, watching nonstop mythology episodes can be a bit of a grind is just further illustration of how great The X-Files was in its balance of mythology and Monster of the Week, because you need them both.
You did need that balance.
To make it a watchable show.
Yeah, it's too, I mean, it is too much to do mythology. But in terms of just getting the information and seeing it as one cohesive story, I think people would be surprised as to how it holds together, perhaps more than they previously thought. So, I would recommend it.
Good stuff. So thank you for that, Erica. And thanks for everyone for tweeting your thoughts to us. We always enjoy hearing them. Tweet at us anytime at XFD Podcast, and we look forward to seeing you on Twitter.
Mold of the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen. Apocrypha.
Yeah.
I, first of all, really liked this one. I think it was a lot more solid than Piper Maru. And I think maybe in a similar way that Nisei and 731, I feel like the first one had this like insane information dump. And then the second one was just sort of slightly more palatable, like easy to comprehend. Like I didn't find myself confused during this episode, which I can't really say the same for Piper Maru. But I did really enjoy it. Did you have you haven't seen this one in a while, right? I think you said that.
I have not watched it in a while. And boy, it was not that familiar to me. I'm like, wow, I really, Piper Maru was quite familiar to me. I think I watched that one more often than Apocrypha. Mm-hmm. I'm still not a huge fan of Apocrypha, which, you know, I'm sure we'll get into further discussion of. It's not super hard to follow, but it just doesn't do a lot for me. In terms of, like, you know, Mulder and Scully interaction, in terms of sort of character stuff, which is, you know, those are the things that I really am at the table for. I don't love the black oil either. So we'll get into all of that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it's still not, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a very competent episode.
Yeah.
But it's just never going to be one that has my heart, I don't think, the way a lot of the mythology ones do up to this point. Really, all of them do to some extent.
Oh, and I agree with
this
that.
This is when Yeah, this is when they start to kind of, my heart starts to withdraw from the mythology a little bit at this point. And rewatching it now didn't change that yet.
Wow, already.
I know, I'm sorry.
Okay, well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, though, the purpose of our myth arc series is to sort of unpack it and make sense of it, not necessarily bring it closer to our hearts. So
yeah, no, this might bring it to someone else's heart. And the discussing of it is still very interesting to me, because at least it gets me to a point where I sort of accept the validity of these episodes, which I didn't necessarily even get to that point the first time I watched them.
Right.
So being able to sort of work through the plot points is still really important, I think. And you know me, like first impressions are lasting impressions with me in X-Files episodes. Mm-hmm. And this one just, I found a bit meh when I first watched it. And I still kind of find it a bit meh, but let's see how I feel after we discuss it.
Wow. Okay. Well, that surprises me. But again, like I said at the beginning, I'm just basing this on comprehensiveness, on the fact that I am still with it. I'm still with it.
Okay.
The myth arc.
Okay.
All right. So, Apocrypha. I looked this up, and apparently this is like a series of Bible books that was translated into Greek. I thought maybe you might know more about this than me.
I do. I actually asked my husband, who happens to be a minister in the United Church of Canada, and said, okay, I know you have like a whole degree in this stuff, but can you explain to me in 30 seconds what the Apocrypha is? And he did a very nice job of it.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, you're right. It was a series of books that basically, to put it in my understanding of it, because I don't understand much of this stuff, these are like about 14 books that made the first cut of the Bible, the one that was released in Greek, as you say, and were dropped in the next version of the Bible, which was in Hebrew. So they're
cutting room floor books.
Cutting room floor books.
Wow.
They basically went through these books and for various reasons found them in some way problematic, like it's just boring, or this doesn't quite work, or for whatever reason they didn't think it belonged in the Bible.
So ironic, given that
they popped them onto the cutting room floor, although they still are often in the Bible, and in some denominations still recognize them as canonical books. Mm-hmm. Like a Catholic Bible, for example, is likely to have at least some of these books as canonical books. The most Protestant Bibles include them, but not as part of the canon, but they're still just included for your information. And so that's what I learned about the Apocrypha.
I think that's funny. I was going to make a joke that you said essentially that they left them out because they're too boring and they didn't really work. And I'm like, oh, well, considering what Jen just said about this episode, this is pretty appropriate. But I don't understand really the connection that has with this episode. Like I couldn't.
I tried. Yeah. Honestly, I mean, I talked to Sandy about this. I mean, I put him on the spot with this whole 30 seconds thing. But then I spent the next like 10 minutes with talking to him, trying to figure out why this episode is called Apocrypha. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I was like, what's the connotation of the word Apocrypha? Is there something I'm missing here?
Right.
And the best that he and I, between the two of us, me from an X-Files perspective, him from sort of a biblical scholar perspective, was that maybe Chris Carter thought that the apocryphal books were more mysterious than they actually are, that he might have been thinking more of what are called the Gnostic books, which are books that are not in the Bible generally and are kind of secret and mysterious, that maybe he wanted to imply that, because the word Apocrypha is from the Greek word for secret, hidden. So maybe he thought of this as, hidden information. Although, you know, the actual books of the Apocrypha are not actually hidden. They're readily found, but I think maybe he imagined them to be more hidden than they actually are. So it's meant to be something that's like hidden information that's coming out, because we know Chris Carter loves that as a concept throughout the mythology.
Right.
It's always about hidden things coming to the surface. So,
or it
shoulder
just
shrug, that's the best I got.
Sounds cool.
It does really. That's another thing that Sandy and I kind of concurred on. We're like, it just sounds cool.
It does sound cool. Yeah.
I mean, Piper Maru is such a literal title.
Yeah.
And then we come to Apocrypha.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is just like this cool, vaguely sort of spiritual sounding word.
It's just funny because I see these like know, sometimes they're Latin or sometimes they're German or I don't know, whatever language. And I don't ever really think too hard about it. I'm always just like, oh, that sounds cool. Or if, you know, there's some really sort of basic Latin that I can understand, then I can kind of get the gist. But this was one that I just never really thought about. And so I'm sitting here just trying to figure it out. I couldn't. But there it is.
I'm totally clear on it. I'll be curious to see if the listeners can kind of connect those dots for us, because I haven't fully connected them, but they might be one of those things that are not necessarily meant to be connected to literally.
It's yet just, another red herring.
Go with it. It's something sort of mysterious and hidden, and just don't think about it too hard. Yeah. That's kind of what I'm left with from that. But it is a cool title.
Yeah. So this cold open I thought was really cool. And I kind of, I don't forget about it, but I forget which episode it's in. When it pops up, I'm like, oh yeah, this. So we have one of the, crew. I don't know what they called, but the people on the submarine or whatever in 1953.
Sailors, I guess.
Yeah, the sailors. I don't know what they call you when you're on a sub.
They refer to him as crewman. Sailor. They address
how
the
about
sailor,
crewman.
Right?
Okay.
Well, Submariner, I think, is the usual term, actually.
Okay. Wow. We're good. We're going deep, Jen. This is a deep dive.
That's literally.
It is a literal deep dive. Okay. So we are in Pearl Harbor, and he is clearly suffering from these radiation burns. This guy is what? The last survivor, I'm assuming, from this. And these mysterious dudes are there, these men in black type dudes, and they're trying to get information out of this. And I just think, I mean, we basically get a recap of what we learned in Piper Maru. I don't think there was necessarily any new information other than the fact that we now find out that the syndicate is clearly onto this and, you know, most likely responsible for this cover up.
From the beginning.
Yeah. And I think that, like, when he says Mr. Mulder and then it cuts to Bill Mulder, I think that's such a cool moment, because we're not used to that yet in this show. Like, by the time the revival came around and we're seeing, like, these old guys standing around in suits, like, you kind of get what that is. But I would imagine at this point in season three, like, seeing these kinds of things in flashbacks is still relatively kind of new and surprising. So I think that was a really cool moment. And then obviously it turns to this guy playing the smoking man, who I thought did a really good job of kind of getting his mannerisms down.
He did, and he's holding the cigarette just the right way and all of that stuff. They felt compelled for some reason to dub William B. Davis's voice in, which I'm not totally sure was absolutely necessary and was a bit distracting to me.
I've been thinking about this because I'm trying to decide if I like it or not. And I kind of do, because I think it's as cheesy as it is and as unnecessary as it is. I just think it adds to his character and makes him even more like dubious. I don't know. Like I because it so did not fit this human I'm looking at, and then William Davis' voice comes out and I'm just like, that's not right. But I still found it enjoyable, because it almost felt mythical and like unreliable narrator-esque, and I don't know. I enjoyed it in that way.
I can kind of see where you're coming from. That's not literally how he sounded at the time.
Yeah.
But maybe that's how CSM remembers it, or something like
that. Something
like
that. So yeah.
Something like that.
It was just funky enough for me to enjoy it. So,
Okay. I can go with that. And I can only assume that they just were a little nervous that people wouldn't make the connection about who that was.
Yeah.
And they can't address him by name.
Because
we can address Mr. Mulder
by
name and know who that is. But we can't address CSM by name and know who that is. No one's going to say, what do you think, CSM? And so they have to do something to really make it clear.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, I mean, I always say how much I love that Chris Carter doesn't treat his audience like idiots. I really do think that they didn't need it. Like, I think anyone watching would have known without that.
Yes.
I guess
I don't think we needed it, but you never know. The casual viewer,
never
maybe,
know.
Who knows?
You never know. And I mean, I also have to think of this as a product of the time. I mean, you know, people don't watch it obsessively like us. They don't repeat it. You watch it once and then you forget about it. And then a week later you watch another episode, and people are consuming this show differently. And so I have to kind of take that into account.
And you may not necessarily even be looking at the screen during that moment. And so you don't see the cigarette. So you need to hear something to kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it worked.
Just really hammer it. We don't, they're doing their best to help us to keep up here.
Yeah.
They're doing their best. They're giving us the notes that we need.
In episodes like this, especially the Mitharc episodes, it's like the less we have to work on things like this, then the more brain room we have to like work on all the other stuff that we actually need to be working on. Yeah.
Exactly right.
I can appreciate it in that way.
When we can make something simple, let's make it simple.
Yeah.
I did like what the survivor sailor said about when he says, they said I owed it to the dead to tell them the truth, talking about the Navy. I find that an interesting line because it will kind of figure into that theme later in this episode, the idea of the dead speaking and what we owe the dead. Mm-hmm. And so I find that was an interesting line from the opening scene that we'll see sort of come up again in the final scene. So I like me a theme. And so I like the fact that it kind of came up in that scene.
Yeah.
And I like that line. You know, I'm a whore for any time they mention the truth. So
oh, God. Yeah.
And I enjoyed it.
It is a nice little parallel that I did not pick up on. So thank you for pointing that out.
You're welcome.
So we are picking up with poor Skinner having gotten shot by Louise Cardinal. And I wanted to comment on this scene and see what you had to say, because, man, you got to love bossy Scully. Like,
oh, my
she
God.
Is like she. And I have to say, and I'm wondering if you agree with me, almost off-puttingly bossy.
Yeah.
Would you agree with me?
All I can ever think. And this is actually one of the few things I remember very clearly from this episode. Mm-hmm. And that is thinking the first time I watched it, who does Skelly think she is here?
Yeah, like, right? Like,
I don't see how she has the authority to do any of this.
To talk to those people like she did. And I mean, I get it that like she's, you know, she's frazzled and Skinner is hurt and she's upset. I get it. But it's like she is really seems to be taking on like the role of like FBI director suddenly. And these other I can tell these other two agents, Agent Fuller and Agent Kaleka, apparently are their names. I can tell that they're like really trying to give her a wide berth. But like both of them are like this close to being like, hey, stand down, little redhead. Like, you are taking this a little bit too far. I just remembered thinking that when I watch it. And I do think that every time I watch this episode. So I'm really glad that you said that. Okay.
It is slightly off-putting.
Okay.
And I think you're right about how the other two agents play it, that they're not being, like, openly defiant in any way.
Right. But they're giving
Scully some room here.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can kind of read that they're not really
buying this completely. They're giving each other the side eye.
Yeah, they're like, what's this all about?
We've never seen these people before, and we're never going to see them again. And very likely, they've never seen Scully before and are never going to see Scully again. And it's all just so weird. Okay.
It's a bit weird. But, you know, I give those agents credit for being professional, because I think if it would have been me, I don't know if I would have been quite that professional. I would have been like, since when are you giving orders? Especially in that later scene where she's getting really quite sort of snotty with him, and like, I don't care if you have to stand outside this room yourself.
Yeah.
Get someone to guard this man.
Yeah.
It's like, chill, dude. So I give them credit for not being rude, because I think I might have been.
Yeah. And, you know, it kind of ties into the scene like later when, and I don't think we're not there yet. It's later when she's talking to Skinner, but like, he's very mansplainy to her later, and we'll get to that scene. Skinner is, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this.
Okay.
But it's
all right,
and I don't want to, mansplainy is not the right word, but he's very like, settle down, you emotional woman. Like, don't get your emotions. They're too much, and they're gonna make a mistake, and blah 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 blah. And it's kind of like he comes out of nowhere with that in that scene when she really hadn't done anything to deserve that. But I was like, it's almost like he was supposed to be present at this scene, but wasn't. And I want to be like, it felt very weird that like he came in later and was almost telling us viewers to be like, oh my God, she's being so emotional and she's bossing these people around, this crazy emotional woman. And like, it gave me these just weird, weird misogyny vibes. And I had to just point that out. But
well, that's an interesting take. And I don't disagree at all. I mean, that's a valid take. It never really troubled me. I saw it more as, for some reason, I read it more as like, mentor agent saying, you know, I've been where you are kind of thing. I know how this can affect you. Because that specifically happens at the moment when they're talking about Melissa.
Yeah.
And so I think he's he's trying to say, you know, I'm your mentor, I'm your FBI dad, I just, you know, I want to share my knowledge and wisdom with you, and just know that, you know, don't let your emotions get away. It isn't based on a lot. I definitely agree with you. Within that scene, she doesn't seem especially emotional. She does get a little angry, and I think Skinner seems to slightly overreact to that.
Yeah, that's my
maybe
point.
He's just he's not used to seeing Scully angry at all, I guess, but I think it's... considering Scully's reaction within that scene, his reaction seems a little over the top.
That's all I'm saying. And I don't want to overestimate this and say that, like, it troubled me. It didn't trouble me. It just kind of gave me a weird vibe. Like, you know, when you're watching these things in the context with the time and the character that Scully is and the character they're trying to create her to be, and then you see exchanges like that, I can't help but wonder... Mm. What the context is of that and where that came from and why. Because it's like his line, I wrote it here, his line is, if you can't keep your head, it's all right to step away, which is something that, you know, she says to Mulder all the time, essentially, whenever Samantha is brought up. So it's not like this is a sexist thing. It was just the way he said it, and he said it to her when she really wasn't behaving in any way that was alarming. Yeah. You know,
it didn't necessarily warrant that kind of response. If they had played even the line she had, she could have played it a bit more angry and a little more wound up, and it would have been more convincing all the way around. But she just doesn't seem angry enough to warrant that response.
Exactly. That's my only, that was
from Skinner. So I feel like if they had just played that scene a little differently, it would have worked better. But
yeah.
I always love Skinner and Scully together. So
yeah,
I can have no problems with any of it. I loved it all.
Don't get me wrong. I think that these scenes are really nice, and I like to see them together. And I mean, my God, we got some like hand holding action. Oh. The Scully Skinner shippers rejoice. Apparently,
oh my God, honestly, are there Scully Skinner shippers? I mean, I think there have been.
I know that's a thing that exists. It's not anything that I'm interested in, but I'm sure that there are people out there interested in that.
I feel for the Scully Skinner shippers. I'm not going to join them, but I'm kind of like, I'm on the periphery. Like I am with, in a sense of being a Mulder Krycek semi quasi shipper.
You are slowly sliding that MSR card away and under the door a little bit more every week, Jen.
No. I'm just adding to it. I'm clutching the card. Mm-hmm. Of course, the card is emblazoned on my heart. But I'm just adding an extra little, you know, there's just room for lots of different kinds of love. That's all I'm saying. And I'm never going to get behind the Scully Skinner ship, but I can kind of appreciate it. I would say that I am a Scully Skinner friendshipper, in the sense that their friendship, I am more emotionally invested in the connection between them than I would normally be between sort of regular friendships.
Oh, sure.
So I mean, I'm very into everything happening between them, but not in a romantic sense, but I'm not that far off.
You are all over the map, Jen. I'm a hard no. I'm really easy on this topic. It's just a hard no.
You've got a nice clear idea, whereas I just have a lot of feelings all the time, and sometimes they don't make sense.
Clean and simple, you know? I got my ship. I'm fine. I'm happy with my ship. I don't need to be thinking about these other ships. No. I don't need to think about the potential of these other ships.
I don't know how it happens. It just sometimes does. So I want to hear from the Scully Skinner shippers. I want to hear from them.
To each their own.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their something.
Absolutely.
It's not my something, but
I'm going to go on AO3 and check out the Skinner Scully stuff there. I've never done that before.
God. So you enjoy that.
I'm not
going
to read
Jen.
Anything explicit. I'm not into that, but I mean, if there's just something nice, I might have to read that now just to see what it's like.
I mean, we're talking about two completely different things here. Like, of course I friendship Scully and Skinner.
Yes.
Everybody should.
They should.
But I don't like getting this murky conversation that's like, friendshipping and shipping. That's two different things, Jen. It's two different things.
No, they are. You're right.
Yeah.
But, you know, I appreciate it from afar as a ship. I'm not going to ship them, but I totally get it for the people that do. Maybe there's like a tiny part of me that does. I can't really explain any of this.
Oh my
I need to go within myself. I haven't fully appreciated where exactly I stand on this yet.
All right. Well, you have to do some soul searching and come back to me, and we'll see if you have to revoke your MSR card.
Well, I think once I read the fanfic, that'll tell me where I stand. That usually is a good indication. Like if I'm like, do I ship this couple, and I start reading a fanfic with them in it, and I'm like, no, this is not working for me, or this is interesting. Next thing you know, boom, I'm right down the rabbit hole. But that hasn't happened with anyone on the X-Files aside from our dynamic duo.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear.
Okay.
All right. Let's get back to the episode here.
Yeah.
We've gone on quite a tangent that was not intended. Okay. So we have Mulder and Krycek, our dynamic duo. Your other favorite ship, Jen. You're just all over the place today. You are in it. You know, you're just like a pig in shit on this episode.
I should really like this episode more than I do.
I'm starting to
convince myself. Yeah. Okay.
So Mulder and Krycek are in the car, and he's trying to get. Krycek's clearly taken over by the black oil at this point. Mulder does not know this, but they're trying to get to the digital tape, which, again, it's a nice little thread, because this digital tape has just continued to pop up since what, Blessing Way, right?
Yeah, so I love the digital tape.
Yeah, I mean, and that digital tape is like a really nice sort of easy explanation for all of this information that's coming out and all of these little data leaks. And it's a nice, very convenient little plot device, this digital tape. I really enjoy it.
I enjoy it, and it becomes a very valuable object, which is always nice. Something nice and simple, we want that object.
And it makes Krycek valuable, and it makes his character apparent. And anytime Krycek shows up, I enjoy that. So even though it's not technically Krycek, he's still pretty to look at, so I'll enjoy it.
Oh, he is.
So they get run off the road by, I'm guessing these are syndicate guys, but they don't quite ever make it clear who these guys are.
I guessed only that it was syndicate guys once CSM shows up at their hospital. I would not have made that connection, but that's the only, and even within that scene, I'm not sure if I ever figured it out the first time I watched it. That's those guys. Oh, okay. So
you're watching it and you're like actually paying attention, it's totally it's totally clear. Like
this makes total sense now.
It is amazing how many times I watch some of these episodes and I just literally stop paying attention, and I'm just like, oh, look at pretty Mulder. He's so pretty. Look at Krycek.
And there is a lot going on in these episodes, and sometimes your brain just takes a little break.
Yeah.
I mean, even when I'm watching it, you know, this week, knowing that we're going to talk about it, I sometimes realized, oh, God, my brain drifted.
I have to go back.
2 minutes or so.
Right.
I got to go back and rewatch that. I think I missed a key point.
It happens. And I mean, I find it fascinating how the things just all sort of lined up in this episode really well. So we see the Flash again. And I remember last episode that we were talking about Piper Maru, and I was like, do we ever see this Flash again? And I forgot. This was such a blink and you'll miss it, literally, moment. But the Flash is back. Like, the radiation burns. Flash. And I mean, again.
From the black oily thing.
Yep. From the black oily thing. I like your little gestures there.
Yeah.
They're doing it, man. They're flashing these guys. Not in the
flashing those guys.
Not in the fun sense.
Right.
In the not so fun sense.
We don't see the actual glow the way we did in Piper Maru, but we have seen that in the previous episode, so we can kind of guess what's going on.
They used up all of their special effects budget in the first part. And so we just get like the shitty off screen, like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
But again, it's like, because of that, you miss it. Like, you may not remember that happening. But it's you know, kind of important. So
exactly. I don't think I actually understood what those flashes were when I watched it before, but now I totally get it.
Yeah, just fitting in these little puzzle pieces one by one.
Yeah.
So Mulder is conveniently passed out. He sees the Flash.
Usually it's Scully who's passed out and misses things, right? This time it was Mulder.
But I mean, he didn't really miss it. Like, he saw the Flash, and later he sort of knew what the Flash was. So he clearly didn't miss much. But Krycek gets away, unfortunately. And then we have more Scully and Pendrell. Okay, I have to I have to take everything back, because I can see the way you see Scully Skinner. I can see the allure of a Scully Pendrell pairing.
I've got all of my like sort of half baked ships happening in this episode, because Pendrell was great, eh?
But I see it though in sort of more of a sort of cute jokey way than an like an earnest, realistic way. Sure. And so that's sort of maybe what the difference is. I don't know. There are people out there who are really, really hardcore about their ships. I just find Scully and Pendril delightful. He's just like, and he's funny in this episode. He has a couple really great lines.
He really does.
Yeah.
And I think in this episode, he comes off as more of a guy that has a thing for Scully, which we kind of have already kind of established. But it's less of kind of a goofy teenage crush and more of a, I pine for her and she's awesome, but I understand she can never be mine.
Yeah.
But it's very sexy.
Yes, it is. You get that vibe from him, and he's like, if he was sort of a doof in the other episode, he is not so much anymore. I feel like he's sort of accepted it. He's like, I've accepted sort of my role here. And I find that very attractive. But anyway, Scully and Pendril, they're trying to figure out the shooter's ID here. There isn't a whole lot going on in this other than she's telling Pendril to, like, keep checking and keep looking. And literally, does Scully just straight up act on a hunch when she compares the shot to Melissa's killer?
Yeah, that's actually a question that popped into my head just tonight is why does she check this, like, these genetic markers that they got from, like, the hair at Skinner's crime scene?
Yeah.
With the genetic markers that they got from Melissa's crime scene. Why does she make the connection between Skinner shooting and Melissa's? The only theory that popped into my head was that Scully knew that Skinner was kind of looking into Melissa's murder, but I'm not sure if she knew how much he was looking into it at that point.
But he also said that he'd seen the guy before. And so I think in her mind, that could have been enough of a connection to be like, okay, is this just like some assassin that's come back? That's like he killed Melissa. He tried to kill Skinner. Maybe. I mean, it is completely a straight up hunch. It's not like, I don't think it's born of nowhere or nothing, but I do think it's very Mulder of her.
There's not a lot to go on. Yeah, but she senses that there's a connection right away. I think you're right that him saying, I've seen it before, she's like, assassin for the syndicate, maybe. And I mean, who knew there was only one, but yes, there is. And so that hunch pays off.
Yeah, definitely. But I liked that. I liked that I like whenever they sort of use each other's or a little bit of the other rubs off on them.
Yeah,
and this was a very Mulder thing for her to do.
And it was a cool kind of visual as well, holding up sort of those transparencies and lining them up. And it's like, oh, we can all see they match up.
Yeah,
cool.
That was a cool. I like those little science-y images that you can actually like, I don't understand what I'm looking at, but I understand it's the same. That's all I'm supposed to understand.
That's all
so
I
we're
need
good.
To know. Lines up. All those random looking dots are exactly the same.
Oh my God. It's
Eureka.
It's match. Okay. So I do enjoy that. Yeah. So we have this scene, though, where Smoking Man is sort of summoned to see those dead guys that ran Mulder and Krycek off the road. And we get some information here that connects, you know, what we've previously seen. It's not necessarily new information, but it's more, I think, I don't want to say continuity because it's just similar plot points happening throughout the series, which I suppose is continuity. But I like the idea that he's like, oh, I've seen it. We've connected it to the cold open. And he tells him to destroy the bodies, which is sort of Smoking Man's, you know, go-to solution for anything. Just destroy it. Burn
destroy
it.
The bodies.
Make it disappear.
I do love that moment where he's like, have the bodies destroyed. And the doctor's like, they're not even dead yet. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's something about that is, it just seems very chilling.
But he's like, well, that's the prognosis. I like that.
Yeah.
He's like,
prognosis?
Ask me if I care.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just dispose of them. And pointing out again my theme throughout this episode, this idea of having them destroyed while they're still alive, kind of this burying the dead theme that again we see coming up,
burying the dead alive,
which is a theme that we see come up again at the end and a couple of times throughout. So
yeah,
just pointing that out in that moment.
Very nice.
Perhaps an accident, who knows, but I'm making it work.
No, I like it. Very good, because there's no reason they had to be alive. They could have just been dead.
They could have already been dead.
Also, like, I was going to ask this too, and maybe they answered this and I just missed it because that happens. But what happened to the bodies? Like, because Mulder doesn't even really seem to know about the bodies, right?
No, he doesn't seem to know any. He doesn't seem to remember anything from the accident. Like when he wakes up, In the hospital with Scully, adorable smile from Scully.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't seem to even recall at the beginning exactly why he's there.
Like, that's
he's
true. Like, so we
maybe
can
you can tell me. So I think that he was unconscious for all of that and has forgotten a lot of the details until Scully kind of reminded him. So I think he was just unconscious.
You're right. And he did wake up in the hospital. I forgot that detail. But he, I'm assuming that these bodies were just cleaned up by the syndicate. Like they came and they took them away and then they
called what I would take from
ambulance
that,
or whatever. Yeah.
Whatever magical means the syndicate uses for these things.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. That's how I took.
So we have a cool, like I always like these syndicate meetings because they keep them very short and they're always like big data dumps. You know what I mean? Like it's like
you get some
really cool intel from the other side that Mulder and Scully never have. And I always
find that
fascinating.
I love every scene that the syndicate is in it.
Yeah.
You're right. You learn a lot and just I love the dynamic and the way they're shot. They're always very, you know, artistically shot. They're not all like sitting at a table or something. They're all sitting in different places, but they're all arranged kind of in an interesting sort of cinematic, artistic way, like almost like a painting or something.
Yeah,
so
like an old.
I always
like,
love it.
And they never seem to pay the electric bill. I mean, it's just kind of
a little murky.
Yeah, it's really cool though. I like it, and I do like the idea that it is this sort of meant to be this room of kind of faceless white men. They're all the same, but they do all have these sort of distinct personalities and dynamics. And it's like anytime well-manicured man is in a scene, I'm a fan. But like, I just love how much well-manicured man like fucking hates smoking man. Like I live for it. I mean, you could just tell he hates him. I know at some point he has called him a wanker, right? Like you just, you know, it is true.
Yeah, I believe it. Absolutely. He has.
He doesn't even call
him. We get a delightful amount of well-manicured man, even in the scene with the syndicate. He's doing a lot of the talking, which I always enjoy.
Yeah, I love it. And I do like how they don't ever call, they don't call him by his name for the exact reason you said earlier. We don't know his name. But like, even well-manicured man is like, our associate in Washington. Yes. We're supposed to be like, oh, he must mean the smoking man. He's their associate in Washington. He works at the Washington field office, I guess.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way before.
Yeah, and I also, something I really find fascinating is that the idea that throughout these episodes, your idea of where smoking man actually lies in the hierarchy changes and evolves. It's like, at the beginning, you think he's this really top dog. And then as the onion unravels and you learn more about the syndicate, you figure out, okay, he's just kind of a hired gun. And not necessarily a hired gun. He's a high up guy, but like he's not necessarily higher up than these other guys.
Yeah, he still has to answer to them to some extent. Even
he does.
He's, you know, kind of, you know, doing his own thing. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, he has to answer to them in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, he is almost like he's their Washington guy. He's just one of the group. He's no better than them, but he's just one of them. And it definitely gives us a lot more insight into him and makes him an interesting character because he has stuff to lose because if he screws up, we know that these guys will be on him.
Yeah. And I mean, like we say, like every once in a while, we'll have those moments where he has a little bit of a panic or he has a little bit of he loses control. And those are always just so delicious because we know now that like, he does have people he has to answer for. But at the same time, I feel like he's the one in the syndicate who's probably the most ambitious. Like he's going to do he has all these little side projects. And like, even when the syndicate is gone, he's still out there doing evil shit. And I think that's what makes him sort of a more powerful player. He may not have the title, but he has the power. So
yeah, absolutely. I kind of get the impression that the rest of the syndicate is just kind of like most of the time they're talking in terms of covering things up and making sure things remain secret. And let's just proceed with the status quo. That seems to be what they crave. And CSM is there to create chaos and to just do whatever he wants to do to move forward, whereas they don't seem to be, like you say, not as ambitious as he is, but he'll just do whatever it takes to make things happen. And the rest of them are like, oh, my stars.
Yeah.
And so they're definitely,
quite
he
literally,
stands out from the rest of them.
Oh, my stars. Oh, my stars. He's definitely said that at some point, too. I love it.
Love it.
Really quickly, because we didn't we only touched briefly on that hospital scene, which was very cute. And there, you know, we have so little MSR in this episode that maybe we should talk a little bit more about that. But I wanted to bring up the fact that she does immediately tell him about Luis Cardinal and being the man who shot her sister, her sister. And Mulder appears very concerned about that. Mm-hmm. And he even, I think at one point he's even just like, oh, Scully, like he feels bad, you know?
Yeah. And that touches my heart that moment.
Yeah. And we didn't get much of that in Piper Maru. Like, it was very much like, I'm not telling you, I'm not even going to bother you with this information. Yes. And so I do like the idea that, like, when shit goes down, like Mulder's clearly injured and like they have this sort of moment to debrief, that she is being honest with him. And I like that. And I just thought that was worth pointing out.
Yeah. Yeah. Great point.
So, okay, one of my favorite scenes that, because I think it's so stupid, is this ice skating rink scene with the lone gunman. Okay, I don't know why, but every time I think of this scene, I never remember which episode it's in. I'm always like, oh, it's that stupid scene where they're like, they think they're cool and they're like being all covert, when really I'm like, nobody cares, dude, like as if anyone is looking at you. Yeah. It's this whole elaborate ruse. I find it really funny though, and it's very cute, and it's very like endearing of the lone gunman, but I also just think it's like a lot of work for nothing.
I mean, it's like, do they even need to be skating? I mean, I understand that this is a locker at a skating rink, but they don't need to actually take to the ice to, I guess they think this is their best way to sort of, you know, check out the situation, but they could have just walked around probably. They didn't necessarily have to actually skate.
I mean, and like, they're the goofiest looking guys you can imagine. And so it's like, are you trying to stand out? Like, because you're literally like, Langley is literally going backwards on the course. Like, he's going the wrong direction. Yeah. I'm like, are you attempting to draw attention to yourself? Like,
And I mean, look at how Byers is dressed at a skating rink. Yeah. He looks ridiculous.
Everything about this scene just is so ludicrous, but it's not that it's bad. I think it's very fitting for these characters, and it makes total sense that they would do it this way, and it's supposed to be a goofy scene. I think
it is. We need a little bit of goofiness, right? Yeah. Because, you know, this is a pretty serious episode, so it's nice to have a little goofiness. They don't serve a whole lot of, they're not necessary to the plot. They probably literally do nothing. Go and get it. They do nothing, so just we needed a little break. We needed just the lone gunman to come into our lives for a second and sort of amuse us. And I wouldn't take it out by any means. I love that scene.
I think it in this episode. I just think it's ridiculous.
I think, you're right that it's hard to remember which episode it's in because it doesn't really connect that well to the plot. So you could probably drop this into any episode and it would work.
It's like, okay, let's use the lone gunman to try and get this thing that we need. And I remember they have to get something out of a locker. But when I think of this scene, I'm always like, what are they trying to get out of the locker? I don't remember. It's something. It literally could be any episode.
It could be. And a fun fact that I learned, Bruce Harwood, who plays Byers, he's quite a good skater in real life, apparently.
Ooh, yeah. Ironic. He's the only one not
Hagelin,
skating.
Apparently. Yeah, really. Dean Hagelin did not know how to skate at all, apparently, and needed a 5-day crash course. And as you can see, Langley's not skating super confidently, but I think that fits Langley's character, that Langley wouldn't know how to skate. So I think that's fine. I can't speak to Tom Braidwood's skating skills because I didn't learn about those. Mm-hmm. But to my eye, it looks to me like he's like a decent enough skater. Like he has skated before.
He can at least stay up.
Bruce Harwood does look like he knows what he's doing. He's taking slightly longer strides, I think. But I think that just from having spent a lot of time on skating rinks, as most Canadian kids do, to my eye, they both were like decent enough skaters. And poor Langley definitely did not look like he knew what he was doing on skates. So just a little FYI. And all three of those guys are good Canadian boys. Really, Dean Hagelin has no excuse for not knowing how to skate. But he's from Manitoba, so he may have grown up curling. So it's entirely possible he skipped the skating.
Maybe that's why they put him going around the wrong way. So that would definitely come across like he doesn't know what he's doing.
I think they just kind of went with it, which is great. And he didn't have to go too fast to be able to keep up with the other skaters, which was sensible. So I think it was kind of funny that he was bumbling a little bit. It made sense.
It did. It was just funny.
It's a great scene.
It is. It is. It's just so silly. And like, I do like guys. Mulder kind of giving them crap and they're like, oh yeah, you should hire us more often. And
it's so like, cute.
Yeah. Maybe next time we need you to skate around and do nothing, then we will hire you. No, I'm giving them too much crap. I love the Lone Gunman. I just think this scene is very silly.
It's a little silly, and Mulder doesn't necessarily think otherwise. I think he's like, shoulder shrug, whatever, guys. He's but like, you know what?
Like, you could have just gone in and got the tape, yo. Like, you didn't need to get some lace up and rent some skates and do the whole thing.
Off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just.
And Mulder's like sitting out in the car and like wondering what is taking so long. He thinks they've all been murdered or something, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, that's funny. Okay.
Great, though. I love it.
It is. It is. So, Krycek, alien Krycek, goes to Smoking Man somehow, figures out where Smoking Man lives, finds Smoking Man, and he says, I have what you want. And at this point, I think, and we know from the next Syndicate scene that what Smoking Man has is the UFO. He wants to, that's what the alien is trying to do, is get back to his UFO. He wants to go home. ET wants to go home. Okay.
Exactly.
So it makes sense.
That's the whole thing here. Yeah.
Yeah. So does he, and I have to ask you this because I feel like they didn't make it very clear. Does he have the tape and he trades it back to Smoking Man for the UFO location? Is that what happens?
That's what I took from that, because we see him slap down the digital tape at the start of the scene.
Right.
Which seems to startle CSM a little bit. And then immediately Krycek is saying, where is it?
Yeah.
Confused me at the time, because I'm like, where's what?
Like, it's, you have
if you're talking, are you talking about the digital tape? Because you just put it down. So I was a little confused about that. And CSM saying, I have what you want. Again, it's one of those things, makes a lot more sense in the second watching.
And I do
when
like,
you know, he was looking for the UFO.
Right. I do like the way they lay it out and the way they sort of unveil what we're looking for, because I thought it was kind of a cool buildup, because at this point we're still not sure what is he talking about, huh? And I think it was kind of neat the way they revealed what he was looking for. And then seeing the final reveal in the silo at the end, I think was a really cool, it just a really kind of cool, unusual way to unravel it.
I think it's one of those things that we're not supposed to understand it at that point.
Right. Exactly.
But I have trouble figuring out the difference sometimes between things I'm supposed to understand and things that I'm not. Yeah. So I'm just like, am I pleasantly confused or am I just confused?
Right.
But this is one of those moments where you're just supposed to be pleasantly confused. And I think it works.
Yeah. Because, you know, you're not confused for long. So that's good.
What I'm curious about in that scene is, I guess, are we to sort of assume, and tell me what you think about this, that CSM knows he's talking to the alien entity at that point? I think he does.
I think he does, because he immediately knows what he's looking for. And I mean, what purpose would Krycek have to look for the UFO? I mean, he doesn't care. I think at this point, definitely not. But my question is, does this mean that he had the tape all along, even when Mulder was with him? Or did he
my guess is that, and this is just a pure guess, that once they got run off the road and Krycek made his escape, he boogied off to his locker, grabbed the tape at some point before the lone gunman showed up.
Do you think that the alien knew how to skate and went for a nice skating trip too?
I mean, he seems very skilled, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, Krycek can do many things.
See, these
seems
are
pretty indestructible, so I think he'd be great on the ice.
These are important questions that need to be answered. Did the alien go skating? I need to know.
I think we can only assume yes. I mean, that seems to be the only way anyone can think of accessing that locker.
Exactly, exactly.
So I assume that the skating is somehow necessary, so I presume there was skating involved.
I'm going to go with yes. I like it.
Absolutely. Imagine if some black oil had come out on that ice. That would have been something to see. But that's a separate subject.
That would have been cool. That would have been neat.
Yeah. Just like when we're watching hockey, if there's blood on the ice, it's like, woo, blood on the ice. But, you know, that's just the Canadian in me.
So we have another great Syndicate scene where Smoking Man is summoned. He's being, you know, read the riot act again. I feel like he's always like the troublemaker, and they're always having to slap his wrist like, your assassins have gotten out of hand and they're just shooting people all over the place. What's wrong? And he's like, I don't know. Now, don't ask me. He literally is like, I don't know what to tell you. He's so funny.
They're almost like calling him on the carpet, and he does not faze him in the least.
He gives zero shits, and that's why we love him.
Zero shits, yeah. But
I have a question, okay, because he tells them that the UFO is being moved, right?
Right, yeah.
And I, first of all, I have to give a shout out to the Dreamland reference that I really, really enjoyed. He's like, well, why don't we just take it to Nevada with all of the others, which I thought was so cool. Such a nice little 51. Easter egg in there, Area 51. And he's like, well, you know. Or they say with all the others or something. It was just a really nice, again, blink and you miss it reference that ties in later. Yeah, I loved that. Yeah. But my question is, how is Smoking Man moving this UFO?
Is he flying it?
Please, somebody explain this to me. Like,
I mean, I can only assume a train is involved in some way, but that's a pretty big UFO.
And it's like, it's such a huge thing that has to occur that like... considering like the minutiae of like the trails that they always are following on this, I feel like that's just a huge important step that we didn't get to see or understand, that I would really like to know, A, how he got it to the silo, B, how he got it inside the silo.
That's what I want to know. How did he get it into that little tiny entrance into the silo?
How? Did he have super strength and he just lifted it up and was like, here we go, let's just dunk it. Like, how did this happen?
Maybe he disassembled it.
Okay.
Moved it in pieces. Took it into the silo in pieces and reassembled it.
Oh my God.
That's all
I got. Smoking Man clearly is not doing this himself either.
No, he must have had a lot of people.
He's
doing
got
this.
Help, but he also seems to be working alone. Like, he seems to be doing this. Like, it's handled. I'm taking care of it. It's handled. It's like, okay, clearly you have people doing this, but your assassins are out here shooting random people. You hire the most incompetent people to do your bidding, and yet somehow this happened. This occurred and quickly. I just the efficiency of it staggers me. I don't understand it, and I'm very curious. So if anyone has any theories, please let us know.
And that, please. And that it all happened with Mulder picking up a whiff of it when he's all like, oh, hey, look at these ships in the Pacific. This is interesting. And like a whole UFO gets moved across country and he has no clue that it's happened.
Exactly.
I mean, come on, Mulder, wake up. Yeah. It's a bit hard to believe, but we just hand wave it away that, you know, the syndicate has their means.
I mean, I wish they had worked that out, because that is something that bothers me. It seems like a strange plot hole to ignore when it could have probably been explained with a I don't know. Maybe we're just supposed to think it's mysterious. I get it. These things are constantly moved and hidden all the time. Yeah. And I guess I don't know why I'm sticking on this.
I have to say, it never troubled me or even occurred to me that was a question. I mean, I definitely see what you're saying now. I think they definitely couldn't have told us that it had been moved to, where did we wind up in the end? North Dakota. Because we want there to be a little element of mystery about what exactly is in North Dakota. So they couldn't have shown it going that far, I don't think.
No. And I mean, I don't.
A little something.
We don't need to know where at that point. Yeah. I just wanted to know how. And again, I'm sorry. I'm probably the only one in the world sticking on this, but it just bothers me.
We could just say he flew it.
It is what it is.
He flew it in a cloaked form.
They flew it. I like that. They just hopped on in and they took a little joyride in the UFO. Let's just go with that.
Yeah, let's go with that. That would be very quick and easy.
Oh, my Lord. Okay, so I'm going to go back very quickly to Luis Cardinal and Skinner. Are we to assume, because Smoking Man plays dumb, that he doesn't know why Cardinal shot Skinner, but are we to assume that he did put him up to it? Because I can't think of any other reason why Cardinal would be going after Skinner.
Yeah, that's my understanding, because there's a little bit of a mysterious reference in the first scene with the syndicate to our friend in Washington, like, doing something he wasn't meant to do and, like, you know, doing something quite extreme.
Yeah.
And then the second time when we have CSM with the syndicate, they call him on the carpet specifically on the shooting of Skinner, and which I interpreted to mean that's what they were talking about when they were talking about him doing something he shouldn't have. So, yeah, he denies it, but, you know, I take from that, if they think that, then there's probably a good reason to think that, and why not? So I think that CSM was responsible for Luis Cardinal doing this. That's the way I took it.
It almost seems like if it hadn't gone wrong, and Skinner had been successfully assassinated, he would have taken credit for it. But since it was bungled, he's like disavowing. That's what it seemed like.
Yeah, not me. No, I couldn't. I couldn't possibly comment. So yeah, I think you're right about that.
He acted alone. He just had a heart up for Skinner, I guess. I don't know. So I really enjoyed this scene with Mulder and the Lone Gunman. I just wanted to give it a shout out. Like this scene was just delightful to me. I like how they are having this really elaborate explanation of some high tech investigative technique, and then meanwhile Mulder's over here like rubbing it with a pencil. Very, very funny. Yeah, very
it's
cute.
It's quite good.
Yeah. It's just a really good scene, and then he hands it to Frohickey and he's like, this is a really, really high tech thing, you better take care of it. And Frohickey actually like seems to take that to heart. He's like,
he does.
Wow. And I'm just like,
you're biased.
Yeah, I'm like, Frohickey, he's messing with you. It was just very cute. I thought
it
that
just was it makes you wonder how gullible the lone gunmen are in general, if Frohickey actually bought that from Mulder.
I mean, I think they are. I mean, I think they could, they would buy anything, and that's sort of their deal. But at the same time, they're smart. For the most part, they're very book smart. I'd say maybe very book smart, not so street smart.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect example in that scene because they know all this kind of, you know, high tech stuff. Right. And they, you know, they have this really like brilliant theories that sound very convincing. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, then they're kind of baffled by the use of this pencil. So that's the lone gunman in a nutshell, right?
And Mulder does know from pencils being very, very effective weapons, because I'm sure they fall off his ceiling all the time and poke him.
Mulder and pencils, they're just a match.
He has lots of different uses for pencils, and I think that that's adorable.
Yep.
So we have him figure out the number on the data tape envelope.
Very conveniently, having been written on the envelope,
But again, I feel like it's another cool thread that is believable. Like, I believe it. Like, Krycek, of course, would have written the number down, and then they could have found it in this sort of cool way, and it tracks, you know, it all makes sense.
Sure.
So we get a lovely, delightful scene with Mulder and Will Manicured Man, which I was just over here thinking, I bet Jen really enjoyed this scene.
I did.
I love it, too. We don't really learn a whole lot in this scene, and I think that's kind of frustrating, but at the same time, I do like their sort of like tete-a-tete with each other, because I like the idea that we are continuing to see Will Manicured Man like toy with them, but also he's open to helping, but he's not going to give him more than he's willing to give.
Yeah. He gives Mulder some information that Mulder says he knew already, but it's really confirmation of stuff. He hasn't necessarily gotten quite this clear confirmation that that was a UFO.
Right.
This is the first time he knows it for sure. By the way, side point, I love the way the guy, what's he called, First Elder, one of the sort of head honcho at the syndicate. He, for some reason, seems to pronounce UFO as
UFO. UFO. I saw that too.
Right?
Yeah.
UFO.
I was going to bring that up and I forgot to write it down, but you're totally right. And I think that's
UFO.
That's very fitting with his character, too.
It
like,
is,
I will not call it UFO. I shall call it UFO.
I am important, so I shall call it UFO.
And he also is like, he has this weird shorthand, too, where sometimes he just doesn't say all the words he needs to say in a sentence. And so that's like his slightly shorter version of that. Instead of saying three syllables, it's two syllables. It's just quicker. It's more efficient. Yeah.
But I'm too important to say extra syllables.
Oh my God, I love that. That was really funny.
But yes, Well Manicured Man's not quite high up as that, because he actually calls it UFO. Yeah. So
he called it a Foo Fighter, which I thought was a really, really great reference. I was like, the Foo Fighters, all right. I was
Foo
like,
Fighters.
I was pumped about that.
Baby. So he does confirm that for Mulder. Mulder doesn't think he needs that confirmation, but I appreciated the confirmation as a viewer that Mulder was, he's absolutely right. It is a UFO.
I mean, look.
I always enjoy it when they spell it right out like that.
We all knew it was a UFO, though. I mean, it's good for Mulder to have the confirmation, but Mulder already believed it. We already knew it. All right, let's move on a little bit. this scene, though, reminded me a bit of the scene in My Struggle 1, where he's talking to that doctor guy. And it reminded me of just kind of a sort of frustrating, like, cyclical conversation where, like, no information is really getting passed. They're just kind of reinforcing each other and, like, saying things to each other to be like, you're right, you're getting it, you're almost there. It was the same kind of frustration I felt. I remember watching that in My Struggle 1. I'm like, why are we wasting time? Okay, come on. Yeah. We need some new information here.
I think the one in my struggle run is, well, worse for many reasons, largely because it's not the well-manicured man. But right. I think also because in this one, it's not really, unlike most meetings between Mulder and his informants, it's not really about Mulder learning something. It's more about each of them trying to figure out what the other knows, which is kind of an interesting sort of little duel that they have where...
A little poker game here.
A little poker game of, well, oh, you don't know where Krycek is. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like... Mulder learns that without being told that by a well-manicured man. So it's kind of an interesting because they don't, it's not like the usual informant relationship where, you know, Mulder totally trusts him and the informant trusts Mulder. It's more like it's like they're sort of circling each other and trying to figure out what each other knows and trying to sort of read between the lines. So it's kind of interesting in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, and I do enjoy the scene. It's just, it's frustrating when I feel like there isn't too much new information relayed to the viewers, but you gotta do what you gotta do. And I mean, not every meeting is going to have a huge amount of information.
Mulder just picks up a couple of just very little key points about what they don't know.
Right.
And then he walks away with this sort of little mysterious warning at the end. Anyone can be got to, Mr. Mulder.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess... That's how Mulder figures out that Skinner's in danger.
Right. That's true. He does get that warning. So that's valuable.
That's the only sort of really key discovery, I think.
Yeah. So he sends, of course, Scully to go protect Skinner. And I have all these flashbacks of like every single episode where Scully like loses a patient that they're supposed to be watching. Like how many times has that happened on this show where Scully wanders into a hospital room and goes, "Where is this man?" Or goes, "Where has this patient been taken?" And it's kind of like,
"Where did this body go?"
Yeah. And she's always like, I mean, she's chill in like a Scully way, like where Scully's always just like, "Where is this man?" And like, I get going into this situation expecting him to be gone would be different. Like if Mulder were going into this situation, he would probably be freaking out a little bit more. Scully was very skeptical. He's like, she's very much like, "No, I've got it covered. Like there's people there. You're fine." He's like, "No. Go check." And so I don't think Scully's walking into the situation expecting him to be gone, and she's probably surprised to find him gone. But still, this happens so often. You guys, you have got to keep better track of your people, yo. It's just every time. I just found that really funny. And then luckily, I mean, it's one of those situations where she finds him and they get on the ambulance and all is well, and I'm like, oh.
Nice.
Oh, okay.
Ambulance ride.
Yeah, okay. She found him. They're good. I mean, you're expecting to find Skinner dead. So it's like, it was a nice little momentary relief, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's only momentary because as Will Manicured Man warned us, Luis Cardinal is back and trying to like open the back door of the moving ambulance. There's got to be an easier way to kill this guy, right? Like there's got to be an easier way than to board a moving ambulance. I don't know, man. I mean,
I'm not quite sure what happened with that ambulance situation.
I do love the foot chase that this leads to because Scully doesn't have
good
a whole lot
chase.
To do in these episodes, which I think may be another reason you don't necessarily care for them. I'm just kind of realizing that. But she does have this brilliant, wonderful moment where she gets to go completely apeshit on the man who killed Melissa. And she's doing this classic, "You shot my sister!" Like, it's
she's really
great.
Tearing into him.
She is. And I am, like, so convinced that she's going to just put a bullet in this guy's head. And, you know, it's a good thing she doesn't, but...
Yeah, Luis Cardinal's pretty convinced, too. He is genuinely terrified that she's going to shoot him.
He is, like... Speaking of crazy emotional women, right? Am I right? She is in his face with a gun and he is very, very afraid.
Terrified. And I think that it's interesting the timing. We're left with kind of this question that she may have shot him. The only reason she is interrupted is because the police arrive.
Yeah.
And so left as an open question. She doesn't herself choose not to shoot him.
Right.
She's interrupted by events. So it just leaves it a little bit ambiguous, which I like.
Yeah, I do like that. Because, I mean, it's interesting, too, when you think about, like, Scully's arc, too, like, later on, like, season, what, 7, when it's Orison and she ends up shooting Donnie Castor. And that's such a huge deal. Like, if she had shot this guy, it would have been... It would have been murder. It would have been just straight up cold-blooded murder. Would she have been justified? That's a different conversation. But it would have probably been the first time she would have done something like that. Like killed somebody that was not armed or at least subdued. And it's just interesting the way that she was almost spared from doing that, because we all know that how we know from experience, from what we see later, how she would have taken that. So it's just an interesting point. She was stopped, and even the cops are like not sure who she is. They're like, put your gun down. I thought that whole scene was really well done and kind of exciting and interesting, and the way she reaches for her badge, and I'm thinking like, oh my god, is she just reaching for her badge? They think she could be reaching for another gun, or I don't know.
Be careful, Scully.
Yeah, but I do like how badass she was when she like just pulls out her badge. She's like, it's okay, I'm just FBI, just waving my gun in this guy's face.
That is a very gripping scene, and very and there's like a lot of sort of emotions at work, which is quite exciting and interesting, and of course well done by Gillian as well.
Yeah, and just to point out before this scene, I forgot to mention the other scene where she's being super bossy with those agents, and we were referring to earlier, when they were trying to figure out where Luis Cardinal is and how he's probably out of the country and XYZ and blah, 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 blah. And they're like, well, this is going to take a miracle from God. And she's like, I've seen Stranger Things. And then she walks out and I love Pendril's line. He's like, I believe she has. Like, it's just such a great button. It's a great button to that scene.
I love it. It's almost I think it might be my favorite line in the entire episode.
I agree.
And delivered by Pendril of all people. Mm-hmm. I believe she has. Yeah. And it's just like, the timing is perfect. The delivery is perfect.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you guys better watch out because she's badass and she knows what she's talking about in a very kind of sweet way.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that was the best moment of the episode. I agree with you.
I think it might have been. I love it. I had forgotten it, so it was a treat to see it.
A lovely surprise.
It's awesome. It's a great line. Great line.
So Scully calls Mulder and relays, or maybe Mulder calls Scully. I don't remember who calls who. It doesn't really matter, I guess. And they relay some more information. She says that he's looking for Krycek, and Mulder has somehow figured out, how do they figure out about North Dakota? I'm trying to remember. I didn't write this down.
I think that we're together. My interpretation was that Luis Cardinal told them, because he was all like, I'll tell you where Krycek is if you don't shoot me. Right. So I assume that's what he did.
You're right. He gave up the location, I'm guessing. So, okay. So they go to, very quickly, as always, we don't need to worry how Mulder and Scully transport themselves, because we know.
No, but that's just pretty basic stuff.
No. They get to North Dakota, and there's some great flashlight porn in this scene.
Isn't it the best?
Fantastic. Just in and out.
Beautiful. Yeah.
With the crossed beams and the lights, and it's wonderful. Yeah. Really cool.
That's right up there in terms of the best flashlight scenes in the series, I think. It's just beautifully done. And at one point, the beams are almost blue. They're just really gorgeous. Mm-hmm. The whole silo, inside of the silo scene, is beautifully shot and really beautifully lit, and I love everything about it.
It reminds me of Paperclip a bit, very similar to like they're sneaking around that abandoned mine, and like this is very similar to that.
It reminded me of that, and it also reminded me of sneaking around in the big beehives in Fight the Future and the big Jiffy Pops, you know, walking around and kind of mysterious industrial empty locations. It's always very exciting to me.
It's creepy too, like when there seem to be abandoned, like there's no one else. I feel like that always makes it like slightly creepier.
Very creepy. I thought that the silo idea was very cool. I think this idea of like these abandoned missile silos, they seem like kind of a cool, interesting location. And just this idea, abandoned spaces are always kind of interesting and cool, and this idea of using a missile silo was an interesting creative choice, I thought.
Yeah, and I love, again, like the X-Files does this so well. They make something that seems sort of mundane kind of slightly eerie and frightening. Like that's something that, like, maybe you're driving across country and you drive by it and you go, wonder what kind of crazy shit they're keeping in there. Like, it's just something that you would think and be slightly alarmed by. And I think that they do that really well, and this was no exception. So, well done.
Very cool.
I did write on here, shouldn't Mulder and Scully be a little more concerned about radiation?
I know, that's what I was thinking. At one point there's that huge radiation sign, and Mulder's just, let's open up the door.
Let's open it up. I'm like,
I mean, I'm not surprised he did, but I'm surprised that Scully didn't at least try to slow him down.
Right. It was just, especially when they saw the actual victim with the radiation burns. I mean, I would have been like, fuck, we need to get out of here and get some suits on or something.
Something. At least show some concern.
Yeah, and there was just nothing. Okay, I'm glad that you bumped on that too, because I was confused about that. I mean, and I know that they already sort of they slightly tipped that in Piper Maru when they got to the sub and they said there was no sign of radiation. And so maybe Mulder, I mean, but it could have helped to serve to remind the viewer about that, because Mulder did say, okay, well, this thing clearly, it comes up and then it goes away. Like the radiation leaves. Like, it would have been nice if Scully had said, wait, do we need this? Do we need protection? And then Mulder can remind us and Scully of that, the way that that works. I don't think that would have hurt anything. They should have done that. But
just a couple of lines. I agree.
Yeah. So they are sneaking around and they get, as usual, very, 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 very close to the truth. But no, alas, Silo 1013, they don't quite make it into...
Of course, and as soon as we see door 1013, we know that's where the shit is.
We're like, that's the one, damn it.
But of course, they're distracted just at the last second.
It's funny, too, that there's so many occurrences of 1013 and we understand why that is. But at the same time, Mulder at some point, don't you think he'd be like, isn't it kind of weird that all this shit is my birthday? Isn't that a little weird? I think that's a little weird, but he never seems to point that out. But
no, I think if it was my birthday, I think after a while, even one occurrence of my birthday, I'd be like, hey, that's my birthday.
That's true. I remember
multiple occurrences. I'd be like, what is happening?
I remember one time I was in, and I remember exactly where it was. It was when we went to Japan. We were in Kyoto. We went to this hotel and our room was 1219. And I immediately was like, that's my birthday. And I was so excited. And I took a picture and I'm clearly remembering it. And this was one occurrence. And I mean, I get that Mulder has other things on his mind. I understand. But don't you think he'd be like, Scully, look, it's my birthday. Like, girl, come on. I mean, especially since
at some point you think he'd make the connection.
And they see
he's
it every time.
Opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. Maybe this guy's using this number because he's my daddy. I don't know. I don't even know if that's intentional at all, but it could be.
Let's pretend that. I like that idea, though. I mean, it always just seemed very sort of out of universe, this is just Chris Carter doing his thing, but I like the in-universe concept. It's his daddy.
I do like that because it makes me think of when you make passwords and shit and you use your kids' birthdays and even though you shouldn't do that, a lot of people do that. And so this strikes me as so funny that CSM is making codes and things that are oh, it's Fox's birthday. And I'll never forget that. I don't know why I gave him a British accent. I have no idea. But it's just very funny to me. I love it. I love it.
I kind of like that theory. Let's go with that.
Let's go with that. Headcanon accepted.
Yep. And then so the soldiers show up.
Yes. Okay.
And they stop, and of course, what do Mulder and Scully do when confronted with armed men that are really quite close? Turn around and run away.
Run away! And, run away!
They didn't get far.
No, they didn't. And
I look on Scully's face when the soldiers have caught them and they're being disarmed and everything. She's just like, there's something about the look on her face, okay, fuck you guys. She's just there's just an undercurrent of, okay, I know you've caught us, but I don't have to be happy about it. And you guys, jerks. That's just that's the vibe I'm getting from her, and I like it.
I'm going to have to watch that again because I didn't pick up on the exact face you're referring to, but I completely believe you.
She's very pissed off about it, and I love it. She's not scared or okay, ooh, sorry. Nope. She's pissed, and I love it.
Yeah, and they put them into separate trucks, I think, and cart them off separately, right? I was trying to...
I thought they were in the same truck, but I wasn't paying careful attention to that.
I don't know why I walked away thinking that they had put them into two different trucks. It made me think...
have. I can only remember Mulder being put into the truck. I don't recall.
So maybe she wasn't put into the truck at all. We don't know where she ended up going, but
no, yeah,
I did.
But I mean, Mulder's all like, "You won't get away with this," and I'm like, "Oh, save your breath, Mulder."
Yeah, Mulder, come on, seriously, you know, he and I do like that. Smoking Man's line was just like, "You know nothing," or what did he say? He was just like, you know nothing."
He's all a bit mustache twirly.
He's so smug about it. It's like they actually know a lot, but you're lucky that no one's gonna believe them. I mean, he's just so used to this, being in this position, that he was very mustache twirly. I like that description.
We don't often get an actual full on confrontation between Mulder and Scully and CSM, and so I always enjoy that. Especially, you know, Scully's in there; she's holding her own. Those men had radiation burns. Yeah. She's not just going along with what's happening here. No. She's going after CSM too, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I like any time that Scully is seeing something, noting it, remembering it, and like righteously angry about it, I always enjoy that every time.
That's
so
very enjoyable.
Yeah, enjoyable.
Liked that whole scene, shot really well too. I love the dynamic camera and everything. Really cool.
Yeah, I really think the climax of this was cool and interesting. Yeah. And it didn't need a lot. Like they definitely had all those army guys coming in, but like it was just Mulder and Scully in a silo, man. I mean, that's the good stuff. I enjoyed it.
Enough for me. Yeah. I was just glad they were together because there was so little of that in this episode of them being together.
That's true. It's
but
true.
As is often the case in a lot of mythology episodes, yeah. It's just, you know, double your pleasure, double your plot by splitting them up.
Yeah.
But, you know, it makes me sad not to have enough
interaction. I agree. It's always better when they're together. So
it's always better when they're together. And there was a scene earlier that that I forgot to talk about at the time when they're talking about they're in the office quite early on after Mulder's been released from hospital. And
oh, yeah, with Mulder, the big suit.
Yeah, with the big suit. And Mulder's telling Scully his theory. And kind of spelling out the black oil quite effectively for us as viewers that, you know, it's a mean of jumping from body to body in the medium of this oil. And I do love that point, you know, when Mulder's saying, you know, I think that Mrs. Gauthier went to Hong Kong under the control of this thing to find Krycek. And I love the fact that Mulder, that Scully laughs, but it's a good natured laugh.
It's like, this again, but not in like a, not in a dismissive way. It's in a comfortable way. And yeah, he laughs too. Like he anticipates it. He's like, I know what you're thinking. I know how this sounds.
Like, yeah, I know how it sounds. Yeah. He does know how it sounds. Yeah. Like he's self-aware and it's like, it's just a happy little moment between them. It's not a tense moment at all. Because there's certainly plenty of cases when Mulder gives his theory to Scully and there's a bit of tension because she's not buying it at all and he's a little bit annoyed that she's not buying it. But this isn't one of those scenes. This is one where she's not saying, yeah, you're totally right, but she's not really
saying no. Yeah.
No.
She's entertaining
it. She looks like she's like, okay, I will consider this as a possibility. And she's just very chill about it, which I like. And I love it when she says, is anybody not looking for Krycek? I love that line.
Yeah.
And it's just for that kind of, because they have so often that kind of scene where Mulder gives his theory, Scully reacts. And this is just a very sort of pleasant version of that kind of a scene. And I enjoyed it. And there's just so little interaction between them in that episode that's one of the few that I enjoyed.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I was thinking about mentioning that earlier, but I forgot. So I'm glad that you
remembered. Just a lot happening in this episode.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of nice, you know, MSR scenes, we have this grave site scene where Scully goes to visit Melissa's grave. We did have a Skinner-Mulder scene before this that we didn't really talk about. There's not a whole lot, but I do enjoy that Mulder is like, it's a nice scene. Yeah, he's like, I appreciate that you stood up for Scully. And, you know, Skinner is in this position where he's really trying to ride the party line. And I mean, I love how consistent his character is with regards to Mulder and Scully. It's like they see what he's really doing, but he's always unable to admit it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
I was just doing my job. Like, no, we know what you're doing. It's okay. You know, do what you got to do. Kiss the ring, as he says later in the series. But it was a nice little scene. I liked it. Nice little scene. But leads into Mulder going to Melissa's grave, which I thought was very sweet. He brought flowers.
That was very sweet.
Yeah. And I mean, he came prepared. He's aware and appreciative of the fact that they now have both directly lost people to this quest since they began together. And they have that in common. They share that. And I think it's special to see this scene to give Melissa a little bit of quote unquote screen time. You know, they give a little bit more of her to us. Yeah. Leia is here.
Yeah.
She misses Melissa too.
Yeah, we all do, Leia.
Yeah. But I like whenever they sort of, give some closure to these characters that get killed off, you know, and
it's nice to remember them and to go back to them and to sort of talk a little bit about the effect that death has had on Scully.
Mm-hmm.
I could have used a little more of that, but I'd be happy with what I get. And
we got some in Piper Maru too. So
it is in Piper Maru. There's more of it, I think, in Piper Maru in terms of the impact on Scully.
Yeah.
But I do like this. Yeah. It's nice to see Melissa, even if it's only her poor, sad gravestone. There's that moment when Mulder puts down the flowers and he has like a moment where he's sort of standing there looking at the grave as well. And I can almost like, because this is David Duchovny's great acting, I feel like I can see him remembering Melissa, and because he remembers her, he knows her, he had that like quite a strong connection with her in One Breath. Mm-hmm. And it like I can kind of see he's not just there for Scully, largely he is, but he's also there because he respected Melissa as well. Mm-hmm. And that he cared about her, and so we really get that from that little scene, I think, as well, which is nice.
Yeah, that's a good point. And again, that's probably something that David just chose to do in that moment in his acting. Yeah. And that was helpful and, you know, apparent in his character. It also makes me think of, was it The Blessing Way? I think it was right after Melissa died when he said, she was like, I don't think that she knows how sorry I am or something. And Mulder's like, Melissa knows. Like you know, the way he speaks to her as if, you know, I know this person enough to know that she would have behaved this way. And he's not just saying it to be, you know, to be nice or patronizing or whatever. Like believe that he really means it. And so this was a really good moment too, to also show that.
It's very sweet.
Yep, agreed.
I like that a lot. And then we have Scully talking again with all this sort of heavy stuff about what Commander Johansson had said in the previous episode, that the dead speak to us from beyond the grave, and that's what conscience is. Mulder doesn't totally seem to buy that. He's like, that's interesting.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Like, okay, that's fine. And I do like it when she says, I think the dead are speaking to us, demanding justice. Maybe that man was right. Maybe we bury the dead alive, which is great. It reminds me of the line in The Truth, at the end of The Truth, which we've struggled a little bit with over the years.
Yeah.
Where Mulder's talking about, I want to believe that the dead are not lost to us. They speak to us as something greater than us. So this idea of the dead speaking to us is clearly something that Chris Carter is interested in conveying throughout the series. And I kind of like that as a theme in this episode. And of course, as soon as Scully says, maybe we bury the dead alive, it's an interesting segue to Krychek kind of literally being buried alive, which is very cool.
Let's talk about Krychek in a second. I have one more thing to say about this the dead speaking to us and all that. I lost my train of thought. I can't think of what I'm trying to say, but let's go back to Krychek. So Krychek, I remember because I texted you about this, Jen, and I was like, because I just didn't want to like be an idiot on the podcast, but I was like, do we ever know how Krychek got out? Did they ever say? Because I don't remember, but I feel like there might be some sort of throwaway line at some point that explains how he got out of there or who freed him. And I think it's in Tunguska. I feel like Tunguska's the next time we see Krychek. And I feel like it's something about he mentions like that group that he's working with.
Yes.
Somehow those guys helped him out. I feel
that's
like that's
my recollection. Yeah.
Yeah. But I can't remember how or why or when, because he certainly couldn't have lasted very long in there. Right. He doesn't have water. He doesn't have food. And so.
No. Even without water, you wouldn't last for, I don't know, longer than a day or something that.
So it is an interesting mystery how Krychek is somehow able to get out of the silo. But I do enjoy the cliffhanger for him, because I'm sure at the time y'all didn't know if Krychek would be back or if that was.
No, we thought that would be the last we ever saw of him.
Yeah. And it would have been a fitting end for Rat Boy.
I remember at the time thinking, damn right, you rat. That's where you belong. I was happy for that to be his end.
Yeah, I mean, I look forward to him coming back in season 4 because I really enjoy Krychek in season 4. But
he is in season 4. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, in retrospect, I wouldn't have wanted that to be the end of Krychek, because every episode with Krychek in it is benefited by his presence.
Exactly. So exactly.
I'm fine with it. But yeah, I mean, considering it was such a solid ending and such a scary ending, the way he gets out of it, the kind of hand wavy way he gets out of it, is a little sort of, it's a little disheartening, but you know, so be it. I didn't necessarily need to know all the details. It's like, all you need to know is we need Krychek back in this plot, and he gets here somehow.
He got
it's
out.
Like, good enough for me. Exactly. Like, I don't need anything more than that.
So I think they do allude to it in Tunguska, but it's been a while,
I
kind of
briefly. Yeah. But when we review Tunguska, we'll we'll check that out.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. Put a pin in that.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's Apocrypha. Did you have anything else in your notes that you wanted to add? Because I mean, I thought overall this two-parter was interesting, and it added some interesting elements. Like, I know you said that you're not necessarily a huge fan of the black oil, and I kind of agree with you. Like, I find it visually compelling, but they don't quite do enough with it for me to completely buy it as like a really cool element of the story, because there's just so many different versions of it, and it kind of loses its allure at a certain point. But as far as like building up some of these, like, I like some of the syndicate stuff they did. I like the dynamics among the syndicate, including Krycek. I like those things about this two-parter. I found that all interesting, and I'm still with it. Like, I'm still following it.
Yeah, I think so. I'm more or less following it. I totally agree the syndicate stuff is great. The black oil thing I've never really gotten on board with, just because it's something that's new and that seems to come out of nowhere. You've made a really compelling point that we might see a glimpse of it in Ice, but that's not quite enough for me to establish it before this. We just have so many elements already in the mythology. We've got, you know, all the EBEs, the UFOs, the alien bounty hunter, the whole, like, you know, toxic green blood stuff, experiments on people, alien-human hybrids. We have all of that happening already. Mm-hmm. Those things have not been resolved. And then, but yet, we suddenly feel compelled to bring in something totally different from out of nowhere, seemingly, and make that a thing. And it's like, no, I wanted to like resolve those things that I've heard about already, not add more things.
I do totally understand, but I feel like one of the big things about the X-Files mythology is that we don't necessarily get the resolution. Like, you're not going to get a quote-unquote resolution for anything. I mean, you understand what it is and why it's there, but you're never going to see the end of it. Like, you're never going to see, because that's the point. Like, it's not going to go anywhere. It's like the bees. It's like, we're never going to see the bees again, because the bees, they're out there. They're just out there. We don't need to see them again.
Out there.
You know?
Yeah.
So I understand that frustration, but I feel like everyone following the mythology will have a lot better time if they kind of try to let that go. Because you're not going to get that. Like, you're not going to get these things wrapped up in tidy bows. That's like, and that's by design. Like, they don't want to do that. As long as these, I kind of look at it as the black oil. Like, it's jumping from thing to thing. Like, okay, now we're on to the next thing, and now we're on to the next thing. And like, the other thing has just kind of been left behind in the bathroom oozing black oil. It's still there, but we're done with it. Like, we're done with it.
Yeah.
So
that's a really great analogy.
Thank you. I just thought of that.
That's a really good one. I think if I embrace that as a visual concept, it will make me feel slightly better. I think you're absolutely right. You're bang on that. We have to sort of embrace the idea that there are no answers. There won't be answers. Mm-hmm. Don't expect answers per se. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe this is the first episode that I started to get that I started to lose hope that we would ever get any sort of like real answers. Because up until this point in the mythology, I believed we would get answers because it felt like it was building towards something to me up until this point. That we were getting somewhere, especially in like around Paperclip. I'm like, ooh, we're getting to the good stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, just as I feel like we're getting to the good stuff, it's like, no, you cannot have the good stuff. Here's something different.
Yeah.
And that, of course, that's the X-Files. Mm-hmm. I know that now. But at the time I felt so sort of let down, like, oh, it's not, this is not going where I thought it was going.
Right.
I'm not going to learn anything about that stuff that I'm already kind of invested in, these elements that I'm invested in. I'm not going to necessarily learn that much about them. There's this whole other element now, and we just got to get on the train and go with it.
Yeah.
Sometimes literally. And I think maybe I wasn't in the mindset to do that. I mean, it's a unique way to do a TV show. And now I understand that's how the X-Files works. I can appreciate it for that. But at the time, it was like, I felt a bit let down. Like, oh, I kind of actually thought we were going somewhere with this. But now I'm not at all sure of that.
Yeah, it's like when Frank, what Frank said on this very podcast, that, you know, at the end of the day, it's just question after question leading to another question. And that's kind of, that was the point.
And I think that, yeah, you're absolutely right that we need to embrace that if we are to appreciate not just the mythologies, but the X-Files in general. The X-Files is about raising questions and, more than anything else, about continuing on in the face of not getting the answers, not necessarily succeeding with what your goals are, but to continue on anyway in the face of all of those challenges. And that's what it's really about. It's at the end of the day, it really is about Mulder and Scully. And we get lots of answers about them. So that's all that really matters, right?
And it's, it's about that X. That X. We're always solving for X. Never going to get there.
I love it.
Yep. By the way, I remembered the thing that I was going to say like 10 minutes ago that I forgot, and my train of thought ran off the rails.
Good.
Scully talking about burying the dead and like the dead screaming out for justice or some line like that.
Yeah, crying out for justice or something. Yeah.
Yeah. She said that, or that makes me think of just the X-Files in general and like why Mulder was drawn to them from the start. That it was like, these are cases that have been largely ignored. These people who are dead, most of them start with a body or some sort of mysterious death, are screaming out for justice. And Mulder and Scully are the only ones down there attempting to give it to them. And so I think that was just her saying that made me think of just their journey on the X-Files together and what they're attempting to do. And I thought that was, I liked that connection too. So
that's really great. Great point.
Thanks.
Love it.
Well, so we are going to take a little break from mythology for a while, but we'll be back with some more mythology episodes. Our next mythology episodes will be Talitha Kumai. Did I say that right? And Heron Vogue. And we are going to have a very special guest on those episodes. And you're just going to have to wait and see who that is. But it'll be exciting. And in the meantime, please, if you have anything else to say about, I don't know, anything in general, tweet at us at XFG Podcast on Twitter and let us know. I don't know. Are you a Scully Skinner shipper? I don't know. I don't really want to know. But you know what? Jen might. So please, please let us know. And we will read your tweets on the show. And we will see you guys back next time on another episode of X-Files Diaries.
Bye.